Chief Judge and the Judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Cadet Armas J. Sunday, ACM number 39760. I note that today's argument is being conducted under the current COVID-19 pandemic mandates from the Department of Defense and other relevant authorities. In today's oral argument, we consider whether the military judge erred in denying appellant's motion to suppress his statements to special agents of the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, where appellant invoked his right to counsel. The agents then left the room, allowed appellant to think about it, which is standard practice and policy for their detachment. And then the agents returned 10 minutes later and reinitiated communication in violation of Military Rule of Evidence 305E3, United States versus Hutchins, Edwards versus Arizona, and the Fifth Amendment. And whether appellant's defense counsel were ineffective for failing to specify Military Rule of Evidence 305E3 as a basis to suppress appellant's statements. Appellant's counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Chief Judge, we've asked to reserve 7 minutes, please.
Very well. You may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Judge Johnson, members of the court. I'm Zachary Spillman, along with Captain Dermody. Together we represent Cadet Sunday, the appellant in this case. Cadet Sunday was interrogated by agents E and K of the Air Force Office of Special Investigations on 17 April 2017. At the beginning of that interrogation, Agent E read Cadet Sunday his rights. Agent E told Cadet Sunday, and these are Agent E's words, they're plainly audible on the video recording, quote, you have the right to consult a lawyer and to have the lawyer present during this interview. You have the right to military legal counsel free of charge. In addition to military counsel, you are entitled to civilian counsel of your own choosing at your own expense. You may request a lawyer at any time during this interview. Then Agent E asked Cadet Sunday, do you understand your rights? And Cadet Sunday said, yes, sir. And then Agent E asked Cadet Sunday, do you want a lawyer? And Cadet Sunday said, yes. Now that did not stop Agent E and Agent K. Rather than stop the interrogation at that point, as the law demands, they continued to elicit statements from Cadet Sunday. Now the agents knew that Cadet Sunday had requested a lawyer. The evidence is overwhelming that they understood at that moment Cadet Sunday's statement to be an unambiguous request for a lawyer. But it didn't stop the interrogation because of a standard policy and practice in place at their detachment that was intended to and in fact did coerce Cadet Sunday into waiving his rights, into reconsidering his request for an attorney. Such a policy and the facts of Cadet Sunday's interrogation are exactly why the prophylactic rule in Edwards was created. The rule demands that any request for counsel be scrupulously honored, and it forbids any further communications, exchanges, or conversations that may lead to further interrogation. Cadet Sunday's request for a lawyer was not so honored, and the agents engaged in such further communication, leading directly to additional interrogation. Now, Your Honors, Agent E and Agent K's violation of the Edwards rule was obvious, and it was raised to the military judge by the defense motion to suppress the fruits of the interrogation that, in fact, cited the rule and quoted it. The motion also specifically referenced Military Rule of Evidence 305 ECHO, which is our codification of the Edwards rule. The military judge committed at least a plain and obvious error by denying the defense motion to suppress. And because of that, and notwithstanding your action on any of the other errors that we've identified in our brief, this court should set aside the findings and authorize a rehearing in this case. In addition to any questions you may have for me this morning, I'm going to focus my argument on three distinct points, and that is waiver, Cadet Sunday's request for a lawyer, And why Cadet Sunday's statements were not a reinitiation of the interrogation. But before I do that, Your Honors, I want to address the facts of the interrogation, because they're obvious and indisputable, but they also prove the existence of the Edwards violation. They actually prove three Edwards violations. And we have the videotape of the recording. And at the beginning, at 8 minutes and 19 seconds from the beginning of the recording, the agents enter. Agent E is in a shirt and tie. Agent K is in a suit jacket. Agent E has already met Cadet Sunday. It's clear from their interaction that they'd spoken earlier. And he says, I told you we were going to explain everything to you, right? That's what Agent E says to Cadet Sunday. Agent K hasn't met him, introduces himself, and they have a little small talk about the fact that Cadet Sunday is 6.5 feet tall and whether or not he can play basketball on the Air Force team. Agent E then says, all right, listen. Before we get started, we're going to take care of some business. You know what this is, right? And he holds up a little index card-sized piece of paper. We can't read what's on that piece of paper, but later Agent E reads Cadet Sunday his rights from that little card. So what he's held up is the rights advisory form. Cadet Sunday, when he's asked, you know what this is, right? Cadet Sunday says, no. He doesn't know what it is. Agent E says, well, I'm going to read you your rights real quick. And at the end of that, we're going to have some questions for you. And I told you earlier, no matter what happens at the end of the day, we got some administrative stuff to do after that, okay? And Cadet Sunday says, okay. So I'm going to read these to you, and I want you to listen real careful. I hope that at the end of it, we can have a conversation, okay? And Cadet Sunday says, okay. And then Agent reads the rights advisory, as I've just covered it, and Cadet Sunday says he understands it. And then Agent E says, do you want a lawyer? And Cadet Sunday says, yes, I don't know, like, why would I need a lawyer? Now, there was inflection in Cadet Sunday's tone of voice. And it's easy to editorialize about the meaning of Cadet Sunday's words. We're now 3 years, 4 months, and 1 day later after that 17 April 2017 interrogation. It's easy to watch the tape in air-conditioned comfort, not in the pressure of that room, and imagine the different ways to interpret Cadet Sunday's comments. But we don't have to do that, because what happened next makes the meaning of the words perfectly clear. At 10 minutes, at the 10-minute mark in the video, right after Cadet Sunday says yes in response to the question of, do you want a lawyer, Agent K said, okay, well, because you requested a lawyer, we can't talk to you about the situation for now, okay? It may be something you can come approach us at a later date and kind of share with us, you know, what you know about it, okay? But we can't really talk to you anymore about it. Like Agent E said, there's some administrative stuff that you got to do, and from that point forward, no secrets here. We're going to call your AOC, he repeats, to come pick you up. And it is clear, Your Honors, that at that point, the agents understood Cadet Sunday's statement to be a request for a lawyer.
Is that controlling?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It's absolutely controlling because any request for a lawyer is a per se invocation of the Fifth Amendment right. That's what we got from Miranda. And it's distinct from a request to remain silent, which is not a per se invocation. You know, I'm going to make 2 points here that I think both answer your question. There's a difference between a request for a lawyer and refusal to answer questions. One is a per se invocation, the other one not necessarily so. But the second point, and more fundamentally, is that this case is unlike really all the other cases we've cited in the briefs and pretty much every case we've been able to find, in that here, Cadet Sunday asked for a lawyer before he had waived any right. In Arizona v. Edwards, in Oregon v. Bradshaw, in Davis versus United States, in all of these cases, first there was a waiver of the right and some interrogation, and then at some point during it, the suspect said, you know, I want a lawyer, or maybe didn't clearly say that, maybe ambiguously said something about a lawyer, and so the analysis followed. In other words, Your Honor, if this court is going to revisit the military judge's ruling that we think clearly found an unambiguous request for counsel, and the understanding of the agents that was clearly an unambiguous request for counsel because it ended the interrogation by their own statements, then you have to address the more difficult question of, well, what about the fact that he hadn't actually waived his right to counsel yet? And there is a requirement to obtain a waiver of the right to counsel. The rule says first, you've got to get it in writing, but then if you don't get it in writing, the prosecution has to prove by a preponderance that, in fact, the right was waived. So this case is different from the precedents in that there was not that waiver first, followed by an invocation, a request.
But to Judge Hugh's question, it's still an objective standard of what a reasonable police officer would think under the circumstances, right? If for some reason they chose, perhaps erring on the side of caution, to treat this as what might be an ambiguous invocation as an unambiguous invocation, it's still an objective standard for us, isn't it?
So the standard, Your Honor, is whether a reasonable police officer in the circumstances would understand the statement to be a request for an attorney. So it's a reasonable officer, not the unreasonable officer who may have been there, but it's in the circumstances of the interrogation itself, not objectively, if we take these words out of context and look at them in the cold reality of a courtroom three and a half years later. But in those circumstances, did a reasonable officer understand it to be a request for an attorney? And they did. We have two reasonable officers.
So if I understand, you're saying the question is whether these reasonable officers understood it, not some notional, imaginary, reasonable officer that we would imagine in this situation.
So, Your Honor, I wouldn't go that far. I would say not some notional, imaginary officer in notional, imaginary situations. Right? It's a reasonable officer in this situation. So in a room where Cadet Sunday had just been told all of these rights and said yes, and then followed it up with some statements. Now, admittedly, there are follow-up statements. And that's why I got into the, you know, we can try and interpret the inflection in Cadet Sunday's tone of voice at the time. But you've got to consider the circumstances. So he's a cadet. He's brought into an interrogation room. He's got these two agents there. They've sort of established a rapport already, but they've created a situation that is difficult for him. There's a power imbalance. There's the concern about being in trouble. He's never been in trouble before. He's certainly got no experience with the law. That's why he's at the Air Force Academy. He doesn't have a criminal record. And they tell him, you can have an attorney present. You have the right to consult a lawyer and to have the lawyer present during this interview. And he says, yes. I don't know, like, why would I need a lawyer? There are so many ways to interpret that. One of them being he's saying, I don't know why I would need a lawyer. But none of them is to say he wasn't asking for a lawyer. And the agents accepted it as a request for a lawyer. And then what they did next is what really builds in the violation. So what they did next is, fundamentally, Your Honors, we see three separate Edwards violations here. And the first one is in what they did next. What they did next is Agent K said, because you requested a lawyer, we can't talk to you about the situation for now. It may be something that you can come approach us at a later date and kind of share with us, but we really can't talk to you anymore about it. And to that, Cadet Sunday responded, words to the effect of, I didn't realize asking for a lawyer would end this interrogation. The reason that Cadet Sunday did not realize that is because Agent E had told him that asking for a lawyer would not end the interrogation. Agent E had said, you have the right to consult a lawyer and to have the lawyer present during this interview. And later he said, you may request a lawyer at any time during this interview. And so what Cadet Sunday understood, just from the words that were told to him, bearing in mind that Agent E said before he read the rights advisor, he said, I want you to listen real careful. And I hope at the end of it, we can have a conversation. So Cadet Sunday has been told, listen carefully to what I say. I want to talk to you about this after we're done. You can have a lawyer. You can have a lawyer here for this. And he says, yes, I want the lawyer. And then they say, well, then it's over. You've lost your chance. And Cadet Sunday responds, wait a minute. Now, I'm paraphrasing here, all of this, Your Honors. But Cadet Sunday responds, wait a minute. I didn't realize that would end it. You said I could have a lawyer present for this interrogation. Now, that comes back to the circumstances, Chief Judge, because of the power imbalance. What Cadet Sunday didn't say was, hang on, man. You said I could have a lawyer here for this. I want the lawyer here for this, but I want to keep talking to you. Cadet Sunday didn't take a lead role, the dominant role in that conversation, and expressly assert exactly what he wanted to do. He was submissive to the agents who were questioning him. That is a function of the power imbalance that exists, not just in the military environment, but in this specific environment. So from all of that, we see that he requested an attorney, and the agents understood his request for an attorney to be a request for an attorney. I'm going to go to the waiver, but before I do, I want to add one more point onto that, Your Honors, which is that their subsequent action was not because they believed Cadet Sunday's request was ambiguous. They did not think, we don't know if he wants an attorney or not. Their action, and we get this from Agent E's testimony, well, we get this not only from what they said during the interrogation itself, that Agent K immediately shut it down entirely. You've asked for a lawyer, and so now it's over. But also from Agent E's testimony at the 39A, where Agent E said, hey, we've got this policy that says that even if they equivocate, once they've said yes, we give them time. And that's found in the record at page 120, Your Honors. Agent E says, that's just a standard policy for OSI. If somebody gives a very clear indication initially, even though the second couple of comments was, equivocation, that's my word, the initial, very clear, he said yes. So our policy in this detachment is at that point to stop and walk out and give him a chance to think about it and to come back in. That's the record at 120. They didn't leave because it wasn't clear if he wanted a lawyer or not. They left because his initial statement was clear, even though his subsequent statements may have been less clear. And that's the problem. That's the deliberate violation here.
So your interpretation is that if he had just said yes and left it at that, they would have still walked out and given him 10 minutes to think about it?
That's right, Your Honor. That's exactly what we think that Agent E testified to. Now, I will acknowledge that later in that 39A, there was a back and forth with the trial counsel. It's found on pages 124 and 125 of the record. On page 124, Assistant Trial Counsel, this is on redirect of Special Agent E, asked after the initial rights advisement, if he hadn't said he didn't know why he would want a lawyer, what would you have done at that point? If he had just been beyond yes, what would you have done? Now, that's a difficult question, Your Honors. It's not a clear question, but Agent E says, if he would have just said yes and not followed up with anything else, we would have stopped completely, we would have finished administrative paperwork, we've been done. Now, that seems to indicate that if he just said yes, they would have stopped. But on the very next page, Agent Evans qualifies that. He says, he's asked, Agent E, again by trial counsel, to your understanding, what would Cadet Sunday have needed to do to shut down the interview? And Agent E answers, what he did the first time, just say that he did not want to talk to us. He had already done that once and we stopped. So it was my impression he knew exactly what to do if he didn't want to talk to us. In other words, Agent E is clear that he had said, I want to stop, what he did the first time, I want the lawyer, I want to stop, and they stopped, but then reapproached nevertheless. So it is clear from the record that there was a policy there to reapproach after somebody asks. And, Your Honors, at no point did any of these agents, or trial counsel, or the military judge, or defense counsel, and that comes to the second issue of ineffectiveness, at no point did anyone say to Agent E, now wait a minute, you've got a standard practice and policy. Your policy is what if not to pressure a suspect to change his mind about a request for an attorney? Because that's the consequence of this policy. Nobody litigated that. But that's the deficient, at one point, that's the deficient performance of the ineffectiveness issue. The failure to litigate or the failure to preserve if waiver applies is the deficiency that we allege. But more fundamentally, Your Honors, and this will turn to the waiver point, this court has the ability to look beyond any waiver. As part of your plenary review, you have the ability to pierce through that and actually review the issue. And you should do that in this case, in part because it's not just the defense who has a duty to ensure that the accused's rights are protected. The military judge also has a duty, and so too does the trial counsel. You might think, well, this is litigation. There are parties. They take opposing sides, and that's true. But the trial counsel is the representative of the government. And the government is not any ordinary party. It's a sovereignty that has a duty to seek justice just as much as it has a duty to convict. And so when faced with an obvious Edwards violation, which is what we believe we have here, the trial counsel has an obligation to ensure that it's litigated. Now, fundamentally, there's no waiver here because the defense moved to suppress the fruits of the interrogation on the basis of a violation of Cadet Sunday's Fifth Amendment rights, which is the precise issue that we're arguing right now. They didn't move to suppress on some alternative basis or through some other rule that didn't present this.
Well, they did specify right to silence, right, and not the right to counsel.
Well, they pointed at Edwards in the motion, Your Honor. And there's certainly some conflation of the two rights, I think. But they specifically cite the Edwards rule. I'm sorry, I'm trying to find the... in their motion to suppress, and then we believe again on the record.
Even...
They were citing to De La Rosa.
Even though they did cite to that in the motion, the judge seemed to shape the discussion as it went forward by asking defense if they were focused on what happened after the second invocation of rights. Wouldn't defense counsel's answer to that question serve to essentially waive the initial invocation with respect to the rights to counsel? I mean, at that point in time, defense is definitely well aware of the ability to raise that issue, and they seem to have affirmatively walked away from it.
Well, we don't agree they affirmatively walked away from it, Your Honor, because what the military judge did not say is, hey, what about this Edwards issue? What about the fact that he asked for a lawyer, but they kept talking after that? But if it's a waiver, that's the ineffectiveness, right? If they failed to say, no, Your Honor, we've also got this Edwards issue, then that's where they were ineffective. Our broader position is that a military judge cannot be willfully blind to this. We don't know for certain that the military judge saw this issue when the defense was asked, so are we talking about the first part or the second part? But considering the way it was briefed at trial and the testimony of Agent E, it seems unavoidable that the military judge realized this issue was there and directed the defense away from it. And that sort of coyness, we think, should not be allowed in a court-martial, because the military judge has a duty to protect the accused's rights, especially when we're talking about a heightened right for the military accused. Now, beyond that, I'm going to cover one of those, but there are really three other reasons why this court should look beyond any waiver. The first is that the record is well-developed. All of the facts you need and all of the evidence you need are in this record. There's no additional fact-finding you might wish for, so you're able to review this issue. The second is the egregiousness of the agent's conduct. We see the agent's conduct not just in first asking additional questions that elicited additional responses, but then leaving the room to let him think about it, and then coming back into the room and re-advising his rights. Those are the three separate violations of Edwards, and it was all because of a policy that they had to do that. We see that as truly egregious and requiring review. And the third is that waiver invites the IAC issue. And considering the IAC issue requires looking for deficiency, which takes you right back to the merits. And so the cleanest way to address this case is to say it doesn't matter whether or not it was waived. You're going to, using your plenary power, review this issue and then move on to focus on the merits of the issue.
If we were to agree with you that there was either no waiver or we should pierce the waiver and review the substance of the issue, is the appellant's position that the initial invocation with respect to the right to counsel was in fact unambiguous? And if so, how do you square the subsequent statements made by appellant with Oregon v. Bradshaw, which dealt with an accused who asked, well, what's going to happen to me now? And that served to reinitiate the conversation.
So, Chief Judge, my answer is going to run past my time. May I answer?
You may.
Your Honor, we do believe, Judge Key, we believe that it was unambiguous. And we see that both from the language, but more importantly, from the response of the agents. The agents saw it as unambiguous, and they were the only ones who can experience the atmospherics of the room. And if it was, you know, there's something that Agent E said later on, after Agent K said, well, you've asked for a lawyer, and Cadet Sunday said, well, I didn't realize that would end the interview. At that point, Agent E said, what are you saying? Cadet Sunday was never allowed to answer that question. Had they asked that initially, when he says, yes, I don't know, why would I need a lawyer? Had their immediate response been, hang on, what are you saying? Look, you have the right to a lawyer. We're not saying whether you need one or not. Are you asking for one or not? That would be ambiguous. But they didn't do that. They said, you've asked for a lawyer, it's over. That's part one. Part two is Oregon v. Bradshaw is a post-waiver case. There'd been a waiver, then there was an invocation, then there was a transfer where it was, so what's going to happen to me now? This is not a post-waiver case. And so we do not concede that an accused has to unambiguously request counsel prior to waiving his right to counsel. In fact, we see it the other way around. The suspect has to, at a minimum, waive his right to counsel by a preponderance of the evidence, right? If he doesn't do it explicitly, says 305E1, then the prosecution in 305E2 has to show by a preponderance of the evidence that he waived his right to counsel. And so we don't agree that initial request for counsel has to be unambiguous. We see it as the other way around. The last part, Your Honor, is that Oregon v. Bradshaw is easily distinguished on the facts. There was a request, there was a clean break with no more conversation, and then the suspect said something to a different officer in a different place under different circumstances. Here, the request for counsel was Cadet Sunday's entire first statement. The agent said, you've requested, it's over, we're done. And that provoked Cadet Sunday to say, wait a minute, I didn't realize that would end it. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Counsel, you may proceed.
Chief Judge Johnson, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Major Jessica Delaney, and along with my co-counsel, Mary Ellen Payne, I represent the government in today's hearing. This court should hold that at trial, appellant waived the issue of whether there was either an MRE 305 violation or a Fifth Amendment violation as it related to his two initial rights advisements. Even if this court should not find error under a plain error standard of review, it should find that there was no error, plain or otherwise, due to the fact that appellant had never made an unambiguous request for counsel, and regardless of whether he did or not, he then reinitiated under Edwards, thus allowing for a continuation of questioning. And finally, this court should hold that trial defense counsel were not ineffective for declining to file a meritless motion. Now, this court should begin with looking at waiver in this case, and there's two different ways in which appellant waived this issue at trial. First, as Judge Key noted in his earlier questioning, trial defense counsel affirmatively waived it on the record to the military judge when the military judge asked them, after the presentation of all the evidence, he asked them from their brief, make sure I understand, the issue is whether the accused statements made after he waived his right to counsel, whether that was an unambiguous invocation of the right to remain silent. The military judge asked the trial defense counsel to specify, and they did. They said, yes, Your Honor, that's correct, thereby waiving the initial rights advisement. Secondly, under MRE 304, any issue not raised at trial is waived, and CAF has held that waiver in the sense of MRE 304 means actual waiver, not forfeiture. Now, trial defense counsel never raised any issue with invocation of a right to counsel. In the motion that they filed, the very heading says we're raising an issue of the invocation of a right to remain silent, and that was their entire argument throughout the brief. In fact, in trial defense counsel's brief, they stated Cadet Sunday seemed to not understand the ramifications of invoking his right to counsel. They don't contest that he made a clear assertion of a right, and they don't contest that the following questioning was unconstitutional. Now, appellant has sort of argued that this court should use its Article 66C authority to pierce waiver in this case. But this case is a clear example of the very reason that we have waiver, to allow full litigation of the facts, to allow for a military judge to make findings of fact that this court can then review. It's to ensure that this court can use the appropriate standards of review on appeal. What we don't want is a ruling in which it incentivizes trial defense counsel to raise only one basis for a motion and then hope they get a second bite of the apple on appeal when they forfeited that right to litigate it fully at trial. And this case is a clear example, as the appellant now asserts that there's some kind of an OSI policy to continue questioning after an unambiguous request. And as he's conceded, that was not a policy litigated at trial. And this is the very reason that we allow for waiver, to ensure that the burden is on the appellant on appeal, if there is actual IAC, for him to put forth those facts to establish it. Now, should this court disagree that this and decide to pierce the privilege, the only appropriate standard would be a plain error standard. It's extremely clear from the military judge's ruling that he did not address the initial rights invocation. In his own ruling, he stated that this is a narrow holding geared only toward that second invocation of a right to silence. He did not make any findings of fact about the supposed OSI interview. He did not make any findings of fact regarding appellant's reinitiation after the agent stopped questioning. And he did not, he did make a finding of fact that the appellant, his statement was voluntary, so he did have that. But the basic fact is there is no ruling from the military judge on the question of the initial rights advisement, so plain error would be the only appropriate standard to address it. And under a plain error standard of review, there is no error with the initial rights advisement or the agent's actions.
So, counsel, before we go further, I'd just like to clarify something. So do you agree this was a custodial interrogation?
Your Honor, we believe we agree that he was entitled to his Article 31 rights advisement, and that the Air Force courts have applied the Miranda requirements to any 31 rights advisement, whether custodial or simply the normal OSI interviews.
Thank you.
Now, in looking at whether an accused has made an unambiguous right assertion of a right, the Supreme Court has been very clear. The requirement to assert the right to counsel is on the appellant. He must make a clear assertion of that right to counsel. And that's in United States v. Davis, in which the court repeatedly said, we know that this can be hard, but an indecisive right to counsel does not require cessation of questioning. A ambiguous assertion of a right for counsel, the fact that an accused might want a lawyer present, does not require cessation of questioning. Now, the military judge in his finding of fact said that his statement to the agents was, yes, I don't know, why would I need a lawyer? So in addition to having the actual recording, in which this court can see all of the nuance in that statement, you also have the judge's finding of fact that includes that question mark after the word yes.
Well, now, the military judge in his findings of facts has a period.
Your Honor, I stand corrected. It does have a period there. But even with the period, we still have that proceeding. We still have, I don't know, and most importantly, we have, why would I need a lawyer? That continued questioning of the actual right. The standard is whether a reasonable officer would understand it to be a clear assertion of the right. And again, in Davis, that court repeatedly said, we're not leaving this to subjective police officers to make a determination. It's an objective decision in the totality of the circumstances. And you can consider all of the, not only the circumstances preceding whatever the accused has said, but you can also consider the statements concurrent. Now, this is one statement, one breath, in which he says, yes, I don't know, why would I need a lawyer? That entire statement should be considered in looking at whether he made an unambiguous request for a lawyer. Now, admittedly, the subjective agents in this case, they did stop questioning at that point. After he said that, they took this to be an invocation of the right to counsel. It's the government's position that they did not have to. At that point, they could have clarified with the accused. They could have discussed with him the need for a lawyer. They could have even continued because he had not invoked the right. He had been advised of the right as required under Miranda and Article 31, and he had not yet made a clear assertion of that right.
Well, counsel, before you move on, if they considered that he had made an ambiguous invocation, are they free to just proceed with the interrogation at that point, or are they allowed to clarify whether he wants a lawyer or not?
So in United States v. Davis, the Supreme Court said it may be advisable to clarify, but they declined to make that a requirement for agents. And again, that's the Supreme Court saying it is the accused's responsibility to make a clear assertion of a right. Now, in this case, what's evident is that OSI does have a policy in which they do clarification. We don't have all the facts on the supposed policy. We have two statements by an agent about it. But what appears is that the policy is if they request clarification or if there's ambiguity, they'll allow the individual to have an opportunity to consider. And that's not against any court precedent, no holding by CAF, no holding by this court, no holding by the Supreme Court. In both Bradshaw and De La Rosa, agents did exactly what happened in this case. An individual made an ambiguous request, and the agents gave him a break to consider. And after that break, they returned to the interrogation room and re-advised of rights.
Now, if he had made an unambiguous request, or we conclude that his request was unambiguous, and the OSI agents leave for 10 minutes and they come back and read him his rights again, isn't that just a straight-up Edwards violation?
No, Your Honor, not under the facts of this case. So even if this court were to say, well, the word yes were somewhere in there, so therefore he made an unambiguous request, the agents terminated the interview at that point. They told him of the administrative requirements that would follow, and they told him they were going to release him to his AOC. At that point, the interview was over. Appellant then reinitiated conversation and questioning with the agents when he said, I didn't know that was going to shut it down. I thought it was like, do you want a lawyer thing for the investigation? At that point, he's the one who actually made the statement that re-engaged the agents. And only after he had made that statement did the agents leave the room, give him 10 minutes to reconsider, and then re-enter and re-advise him. Now, in looking at whether agents reinitiated or whether the appellant did, because there were statements on both sides after he had said, I don't know, why would I want a lawyer? For the police to be reengaging, we're looking at that standard of, are they making any words or action that are intended and reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response? That's the standard to determine whether the police are actually engaged in interrogation. The only thing that the police said was, we still have some administrative things. If you want to come back later, you can. But right now, we're terminating the interview. We'll call your AOC to pick you up. No part of that is reasonably likely to elicit an incriminating response from the accused. And looking at whether the accused then reinitiated, we look at, were his statements sort of the administrative statements attendant to custody, or did they demonstrate a willingness to talk about the investigation?
Wouldn't that just open the door to allowing agents to terminate an interview, leave the room for 10 minutes, come back, read the person their rights, see if they waive, and if they don't, leave, come back 10 minutes later, ask them again, and just continually re-asking them to waive their rights until they do so?
No, Your Honor. Well, if the individual actually invoked a right and made a clear assertion of the right to counsel, the agents couldn't just come back in 10 minutes later and reread their rights. That would be impermissible under Edwards. But Edwards doesn't prevent agents from ever questioning an accused again. Edwards prevents agents from questioning an accused until a lawyer is provided for him or he takes that affirmative step. In this case, he took that step when he said, I didn't know that was going to terminate the investigation. There's only two reasonable ways to interpret that statement. One is that he's requesting clarification of his rights, which the agents can give him, or two is saying is an indication that he does want to continue discussing the investigation. He just wants to make sure he gets a lawyer at some point. So either one of those are indicating on his part to a reasonable officer that he wants to continue a generalized discussion about the investigation. And at that point, he's reinitiated under Edwards, and the agents are free to obtain a valid waiver of the previously invoked right. And again, this court only gets to that determination if it finds on the first prong that he had made a clear assertion of a right. Without that clear assertion of a right, the reinitiation question ends up being entirely moot. So in this particular case, there's no error because of the unambiguous request. And there's further no error because even though the agents, I mean, that is ultimately sort of a moot question since the agent stopped, but the appellant then reinitiated with them. They gave him a break, as in De La Rosa and Bradshaw. They re-advised him, as in both of those cases, and they obtained a full waiver. And only after that waiver did they engage in additional questioning. Now, on the third prong of ineffective assistance of counsel, the burden is entirely on the appellant to demonstrate that his counsel were so deficient that they were not acting as counsel. And in light of a counsel who has failed to file a motion, this court must find that there's a reasonable probability that that motion would have succeeded. In this case, there's no reasonable probability that a motion to suppress for the initial rights advisement would have been successful. And that's because of the fact that there was a ambiguous initial statement that, yes, I don't know, why would I need a lawyer, is ambiguous, it's not a clear assertion of a right, and that even if the military judge had found that it was, they still would have had that hurdle of the appellant reinitiating after the agents had ceased questioning. And that's a burden he could not have met at trial, and it's a burden he cannot meet on appeal. Now, appellant has sort of argued that this court should pierce waiver in order to prevent raising of IAC. But again, there's different standards that apply on appeal. And on appeal, the IAC burden is much higher for the appellant. He has to demonstrate that reasonable probability. If he wants to argue this OSI policy, it's his burden to put those facts on before this court. In this case, he has failed to do so. This court should not pierce waiver to simply prevent future issues of appellants raising ineffective assistance of counsel. Should apply the appropriate burden to the facts of the case, which in this one is waiver, and then a finding of no IAC because of the fact that there's no reasonable probability that the motion would have been successful.
So I have a question about the IAC aspect. Other than the merits as you perceive them of a motion on the initial invocation, is there any tactical or strategic reason for defense counsel not to have brought that as well as the right to silence issue that they did bring up?
So, Your Honor, in this case, this court has not yet obtained any affidavits or declarations from trial defense counsel as to whether there was some strategic or tactical reason. Of course, it can presume that the strategic or tactical decision was the simple fact that they wanted to preserve credibility with the military judge, but there are no facts for this court to find. So if this court were looking to find a IAC under Rose, it would have to compel declarations or IAC from the trial defense counsel to first allow them the opportunity to explain the decisions made in this case. Barring any further questions from this court, I would like to briefly conclude. This court should hold that appellant waived the question of whether he made an ambiguous or unambiguous request for counsel and whether that request was honored. This court should therefore apply waiver to the first question before it today. As to the second, this court should find that trial defense counsel were not ineffective for failing to file a motion to suppress on the basis of the initial rights advisement. Because appellant never made an unambiguous request for counsel or a clear assertion of that right, and because he further engaged with agents even after they had ceased questioning, any motion to suppress would have been meritless and therefore cannot meet the bar of ineffective assistance of counsel. For those reasons, and those contained within our brief, the United States respectfully requests that this court affirm the findings and sentence. Thank you.
Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Addressing the standard of review, our argument is the same no matter what the standard of review is, because we rely on settled law and because the facts are indisputable. Abusive discretion is a deferential standard of review. Nevertheless, when you review a military judge's ruling for an abuse of discretion, all questions of law are reviewed de novo. If a military judge applies the law, erroneously applies the law, then that is ipso facto an abuse of discretion because there is no discretion to misapply the law. The military judge abused his discretion in this case because he misapplied MRE 305E3, Hutchins, Edwards, and the Fifth Amendment. We're not asking for a new rule about those. We're arguing settled law. And so plain error, preserved error, none of that affects our argument. Were you to apply waiver, you still have to look at the issue of IAC. As government counsel just indicated, IAC turns on the reasonable probability of success on the motion, which takes us right back to the merits. It takes us right back to the argument I just made that the military judge misapplied the law in this case. In fact, the military judge made erroneous findings of fact, too, Your Honors. In his ruling, which is Appellate Exhibit 25, on page 5 of 6 in paragraph 14, the military judge said, his first sentence, he's talking about the second invocation. He's talking about the potential invocation of the right to remain silent, and he's characterizing it as an ambiguous invocation. He says this was not unambiguous, but it's clear in the context he meant this is not an unambiguous, and he contextualizes it with the first request, the request for counsel, which was not ambiguous. That was unambiguous. It's clear from the context that's what the military judge has found, but the military judge also found in the second sentence there, the accused told the agents that he did not understand that invoking would stop the conversation and he wanted to continue talking. Cadet Sunday didn't say that, Your Honors. There is nothing in this record that supports that finding that Cadet Sunday said in the first part of the interrogation, before the agents left for that 10-12 minute gap, that he wanted to continue talking. What he said was, I didn't realize it would stop. And that was in accordance with the advisement he'd been given that if you get a lawyer, you can have a lawyer for this interview. Now, Davis, Your Honor, definitely gives us the premise that when an accused requests counsel, it has to be an unambiguous request. But Davis is a post-waiver case. In Davis, a sailor was interrogated by the Naval Investigative Service, the precursor to the Naval Criminal Investigative Service. He was read his rights. He waived. He began an interrogation. After an hour and a half, he said, maybe I should talk to a lawyer. And the Supreme Court ultimately said that that's not clear enough to undo the prior waiver. Law enforcement, it's just good policy, Your Honors, to say that law enforcement agents can rely on an accused's waiver of his rights until the accused deliberately and clearly pulls back that waiver and says, you know something? No more. I want those rights now. That's not what happened here. The rules of evidence and the law are clear that investigators, agents, interrogators must obtain a waiver of the right to remain silent and of the right to counsel before they can do the questioning. It's not enough to accept the suspect's silence as a waiver. There has to actually be the waiver. That did not happen here, and that's what distinguishes these cases from cases like Davis. Now, government counsel suggested that there are only two interpretations to Cadet Sunday's subsequent statement of, I didn't know, I'm paraphrasing here, Your Honors, but I didn't know that asking for a lawyer would end this interrogation. But we see a third, and it's as I said before. The third is Cadet Sunday's merely saying, I didn't realize we couldn't keep talking. Agent E had told him, I hope we can have a conversation. Agent K had said, we're sending you away and calling your AOC, said it twice. Cadet Sunday didn't realize that he wouldn't get a chance to tell his story with the assistance of counsel in this interview, just like he'd been promised just 30 seconds earlier, if he actually asked for that. that he would instead be sent back to his AOC with perhaps a report of, hey, he wasn't cooperative, he didn't participate. That's the third possible interpretation. Finally, Your Honors, why the agents stopped the interrogation is important, but it's not disputable. When Cadet Sunday said yes in response to the question, do you want a lawyer? Agent E looked up from the card and glared at him. Agent K stopped writing, put down his pen, sat back in his chair, slid his chair back from the table, and then said, well, since you've asked for a lawyer, we're done. Now, I've paraphrased that, but that's the impact of the first sentence, out of Agent K's mouth, which was, okay, well, because you requested a lawyer, we can't talk to you about the situation for now, okay? Now, even if you might be able to say that Cadet Sunday's statement was not a clear request for a lawyer, the agents made it a clear request for a lawyer. They told him, you have just made a clear request for a lawyer. And an individual with no criminal justice experience who's just been giving a rights advisement saying you can have a lawyer, you can ask for one, and they'll be here for this interview, who says yes, and the agent says, okay, you just asked for one, interview over. And the person says, wait a minute, that's not what you said. That is a request for an attorney. And that is exactly the sort of situation that the Edwards Rule exists to protect. The Edwards Rule is a prophylactic rule to prophylactically prevent any sort of coercive environment to convince an individual that, no, they don't really want that lawyer. It's going to prevent you from getting a chance to say your side of the story. It's going to take too much time. It's too difficult. You don't want that lawyer. Change your mind. That's what they did here. And as for the policy and practice, the defense elicited that. Well, the agent volunteered it initially. The defense followed up during the 39A. What we don't have is any additional testimony that might qualify it, that might show that it is not what it actually is. It doesn't just appear to be, Your Honors, but is a deliberate policy to coerce individuals into changing their mind. That's the violation here. This court should hold so and should reverse. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Counsel, thank you both for your arguments. The court will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.
All rise.